Yo, people, Anna David with After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, a website determined to change the face and get rid of the stigma around addiction and recovery. Now, After Party is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for treatment centers across the globe. You can go there to see if your rehab stay could be free. Go to RehabReviews.com/benefits-check. What else can you do there, you may ask? You can get a Recover Girl t-shirt. Just go to rehabreviews.com/after-party/shop. Anyway, you'd know all of this if you were signed up for our newsletter. What are you doing? Go sign up, rehabreviews.com/newsletter-sign-up. Now here's the show.
Welcome to the After Party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey guys, it's Anna David with After Party Pod. Welcome to the podcast. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're listening. I will confess that this is an intro I am re-recording, which is highly unprecedented. I only did it once before, and it was for the Dr. Drew episode where I listened. It had already been cut. It had already been sound edited. And then I listened and I thought, dear God, that silly intro, that interview and that person deserves a better intro. And that this is what happened with this episode. So, and it's not just self-recrimination. It was actually true. So here we go. Take two, as they say in the business. One thing I did also want to point out before I ramble is that in the intro, I mentioned that we have these Recover Girl t-shirts. What I failed to mention is that we now have t-shirts for guys. They say hangovers are so 90s, and they're kind of in that 90210 font, but we don't want to get sued. Can you get sued for that? I don't know, but they're really cool. So they're also on the shop page, and we also give them away in various promotions. So I already said this, but sign up for our newsletter to find out more about that. And as for me, things are good. I'm tired. I couldn't sleep last night. No particular reason. It just will happen. I once didn't sleep for a year. And that's really not hyperbolic. I always have had trouble sleeping. And that's why I loved my Ambien. And you know, it's so rare. And it happened last night. And I'm sort of somebody who gets insane. You know, supposedly it takes three nights of not sleeping to be insane. I don't know. I heard that somewhere. But it only takes me a night. I become incapacitated, but I'm capacitating. I don't think that's a word, and I'm here, and I'm actually re-recording. So, a lot of faith in my capacity, apparently. And I mean, that's really it for me. I want to talk about the guest today because she's absolutely amazing. And what do you guys think? Once you listen to this interview, tell me if you think she and I can be good friends, because that's what I want. And I feel like we are, just based on this conversation. I actually knew her-ish before. Oh, by the way, it's Sarah Heppala. You probably know this if you've downloaded. And she is the author of Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget, which is a New York Times bestseller to a ridiculous degree. It's already part of all our cultural landscape, I would say. And you know, as someone who wrote a book about addiction and recovery, which is not part of our cultural landscape, you'd think, and someone who has struggled with jealousy, let's be honest, you'd think I'd hate her, and I don't. I loved this book, which, by the way, we're giving away copies of it, and all you have to do is comment on where this podcast posts on the site. So if you're getting it from iTunes, you got to go to After Party Magazine in their podcast section. Post a comment. Just show you listen to this. Whatever. Just post a comment. And the first five people to do that will win copies of this amazing, amazing book. And so the reason I don't hate her is that the book is so good and so important. And she's just kind of a better writer than than the rest of us. It's just really wonderful. And she's the essays editor at Salon, and she's written for the New York Times and a bunch of other places. And she was actually my editor on a piece that I did for Salon on spanking. I went to a spanking party, and she was my editor, and that was years ago. And I have always been very fond of her in our email relationship, which hasn't been extensive. I'm not going to exaggerate. But that's why I was excited to read the book. And then I was more excited once I read the book. And we have a really good conversation that you're about to listen to. So without further ado, may I present Sarah Heppala.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
About like, are you okay talking about 12-step? But we already
talked about that. You know
that. So, but okay. So what you were saying was that the sort of women in drinking is something people you think are interested in right now. And there's growing awareness about it.
I think they're hungry to talk about women's relationship with alcohol, even not even in an addiction like context, but mm-hmm. just like women that don't necessarily identify as alcoholics, I think are asking themselves, why do I need this? Why do I need this when I go out with my female friends?
Right.
Why do I need this when I go on a date? I mean, every young female I know drinks before she goes on a date.
Well, see, yes, I find that to be, but I don't know if you had this, but when you quit and you suddenly realize that not everyone's like rushing to the bar to mm-hmm. do shots or whatever, that mm-hmm. there are all these people who either don't drink or mm-hmm. barely drink.
Yeah, it's definitely part of the sobriety process is to learn that, oh, I thought everyone drank and they don't.
Yeah.
And some people live a fairly healthy life with very little alcohol in it, and they don't even really notice it.
So strange. It's so very strange to me because I can't think of like what going to college, applying to college, like if that hadn't been such a priority for me, I can't imagine actually looking at college as something like, oh, where would I want to go to most learn? I mean, I picked my school. It had been on Playboy's top 10 party schools, yeah. and yet it was a good school.
Yeah. Well, I went to a state school, and I knew that there would be drinking there. I mean, I remember writing something. I wrote like a fictional account of a young woman in college once. This was mm-hmm. in my 20s. And I remember hearing from somebody in the publishing industry, and she said, you write way too much about like drinking and boys. And I was like, oh. That was actually my first clue that my entire college experience had been a little out of whack.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know. I yeah. thought everybody just basically college experience was just drinking.
Yeah.
And who you liked and what guy was going to like you back. On the side, I took some philosophy classes.
Right.
And those were interesting.
Right.
Like, I don't want to minimize that I was an intellectually curious person.
Right.
But the majority of my intellectual wandering and it was happening with guys at parties.
Right, right.
That was where the action was happening. In classes, I was mostly like hungover. Not paying attention and hungover.
Yeah.
And trying to not, I never spoke in class. Like,
right.
I was very much a wallflower. I didn't participate.
Yeah, I had such a similar experience and all my friends were pretty much like that as well. And I remember one lecture, one time I saw a sign that said Edward Albee was coming to Trinity. He was the one like famous alum we ever had.
Yeah.
And I said, God, I want to go to that. And that was as close, I never went. That was as close as I ever came to actually kind of being curious about something and making an effort to do something intellectual of sorts.
I mean, I can remember doing things like I went to the Huntington Gallery for the opening and looked at Tom Stoppard's original draft of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. But the reason I went was because there was an open bar.
Right, right.
I mean, the extent to which my intellectual journey and my interest in alcohol were entwined, I really can't overstate. They all just happened at once.
Right. And you didn't major in English?
I did major in English. Okay. I majored in English and liberal arts.
Right, right. Where did you go? I went
to the University of Texas.
Okay.
And I did, there was like this major called Plan 2, which was like a liberal arts honors major, which was a kind of an elite program within the larger university, which was very appealing to somebody like me that wanted the caretaking and you know, intimacy of 16-person classes,
mm-hmm.
you know, but...
That you would not pay attention in.
Yeah, I mean, anytime, I'll tell you what, anytime I went to one of the lecture hall classes, I got a C in them or I skipped them.
Right.
I needed 16-person classes because I needed the accountability
right.
of going to them. I mean, I was interested in college. I really was interested in what we were talking about. I just was, I didn't talk much, you know, at least that's how I remember myself in mm-hmm. those classes, that I was very reluctant to engage because I had a very self-critical brain. Mm-hmm. I had the classic overthinking problem. I had the classic female problem of not wanting to call attention to myself for fear of being mocked
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or looking inferior. Mm-hmm. You know, I really looked up to a lot of my male classmates who seemed to kind of just have a God-given right to, like, authority. Like, they had so much authority about subjects, and they spoke in a way that you listened to them,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to be like them, and the times when I felt like them was when I was drinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so then when I was drinking, I could have really engaged conversations of the kind that you would think you'd be having in a college classroom.
Right.
You know, the engaged debate.
So you would do that drunk at parties?
Absolutely. Those were
politics,
my parties. Absolutely.
Literature.
Yes.
Interesting. So you weren't at fraternity parties?
I was not.
Interesting.
I was very skeptical of fraternities. I came from a high school that most of the girls went into sororities. So I really defined myself against that type. I hadn't belonged much at that high school.
Mm-hmm.
I saw fraternities and sororities as kind of I guess I just had a kind of snobbery against them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, if I'd gone to one of these schools where you had to go to fraternity parties in order to get alcohol, I probably would have revised my view of them.
Right.
But I didn't. I went to the University of Texas where every hierarchy got access to a keg party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody, you know, you didn't have to go Greek in order to... you know, in order to have crazy parties. And so I belonged to this little group of like drama nerds that put on shows every
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And we drank Keystone Light and bourbon and we went crazy at our party. I mean, you know, we had a great time. And yes, the way that I remember college was these searching intellectual conversations that would take place from dusk till dawn, you
mm-hmm.
know, during which we'd just be getting drunker and drunker. And it was so exciting for me. But I could never access that kind of engagement when I was sober. I was much more shy. But as I grew older, that drinking persona began to dominate my public persona, which
mm-hmm.
I know is something that happened with you too, you know, where like, I didn't know who I was anymore. I was
mm-hmm.
just this person that I was when I drank, where I was this,
right.
You know, and it's funny because, I wouldn't have called myself a party girl because I didn't dress in the way that party girls
mm-hmm.
I think of as dressing. I mean, I really dressed like a boy a lot.
Right, right. As did I, actually.
What was the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, we wanted, like, it was like flannel shirts.
Yeah, we dressed like lumberjacks.
Yeah, it's funny about that. Like, part of my thing about pre-sobriety is that I didn't notice anything. So it's like, I didn't notice the big things and I didn't notice the little things. And I remember sort of being out of college and sort of dressed how I was dressed and someone being like, it's so hilarious that you're like wearing that. And then I was wearing Keds. And I remember you're wearing Keds. And I was like, there's nothing I picked up on, not trends, not music. I don't know that it's very extreme. I'm still, you know, I'm sober a long time and I'm still like, you use cold water wash on colors? Like just there's so much.
I'm still figuring that one out too.
I missed it all. I never got drunk and engaged in like high-spirited intellectual conversations. Like whatever we were talking about was
I mean, I swallowed goldfish at keg parties. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was not.
Did you take shots out of people's belly buttons?
I think that that predated my age. Like, I don't think we were doing that. We were doing jello shots.
Mm-hmm.
But the using people's body parts for administering chemicals totally came afterwards. Like, nobody did coke off boobs. Like, right.
That was really like the Girls Gone Wild era late 90s.
Yes.
I think. And it predated me, too. It wasn't until, predated that.
Yes.
Yes. Mine was a more innocent time when we took shots out of containers.
Dresses. Yes. Yes. And you didn't do the drugs, really.
I never did drugs.
Not
such
once.
A square. I think this is an interesting part of my story. Okay.
Yeah.
Because, I always understood people out of control as being like they would just do all the drugs. And I was scared of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought of myself as a good girl. And by good girl, I meant that I only did... I mean, alcohol was my drug. It's my drug of choice.
Right.
At the time, I do think there was some old-fashioned fear factor going on.
Mm-hmm.
That I really had been... the warp in my brain of the war on drugs. Like, I really did believe that cocaine could kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember the first time I found out that a friend of mine was doing cocaine, and I was like, should we have an intervention?
Right.
You know, like, I had no...
How old were you?
I think I was in my late 20s. Like, I actually...
Oh
no,
God.
I'm not kidding you. This is not
God.
Under...
Yeah.
Like, I'm not playing this up for comedy. This is, like, actually how... sheltered from drugs I was. And I think it also tells you something about Austin in the 90s. Now, my college friends were definitely doing ecstasy.
Yeah.
And they were definitely doing acid. And I was scared of both of them. Acid because people who had vivid imaginations often described having incredibly bad trips.
Mm-hmm.
And I had fought my childhood with a very morbid imagination and was often imagining my own death and other people's death.
Mm.
So the idea of a drug that would enable that scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
So I couldn't take that. I'd also gotten stoned once, super, super stoned.
Right.
And I started hallucinating.
Yeah.
And it was the worst thing.
Did you only smoke pot once then?
I smoked it a handful of times. I kept going back to it being like, I'm going to figure this out. It's going to get better. And every time it was horrible.
Yeah.
And something bad would happen. And I was like, this is not my drug at all.
Yeah.
And I've been told that like alcohol is the drug for people that want to slow, you know, speed up, and pot is a drug for people that want to slow down.
That's interesting.
I never wanted to slow down. I always wanted to speed up. So I would have been interested in the speed up drugs. So coke would have been my drug.
Yeah.
But I was scared of it.
Right.
Because Len Bias died.
I remember the very first time I ever did coke, junior high school prom, I was like snorting the line and someone goes, Len Bias died.
It was terrifying.
Time he did coke. I know. I didn't even know who Len Bias was because I still barely, I mean, like an athlete. Like,
I don't follow sports at all, but I remember it was on the cover of Time magazine.
It was a big deal. Well, and it's also, most people don't die from cocaine. People die from opiates and alcohol.
People die from alcohol all the time.
Yeah.
And yet I had this false dichotomy, which I think is very common for my age group.
Right.
Which is the grunge era where like we just binge drinking was a totally okay thing.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other, these hard drugs, first of all, nobody in my group would have done heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in my group would have done heroin.
Mm-hmm.
No fucking way. Can I cuss?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Please.
No fucking way.
Right.
When I, like that is something that's totally generational because now I talk to 25-year-olds and they have a very casual relationship to heroin, somewhat like your relationship with coke.
Yeah. Well, and also I think they do because of opiates because they've grown up.
Because like, they've grown up with opiates.
Painkillers. Yeah.
Yeah, with painkillers. So anyway, all of these things are generationally informed, but I was definitely on the square end of the spectrum. I also think what was going on, frankly, was that I never needed anything else.
Right.
Like, I have compared it to like alcohol was like marrying your high school sweetheart for me. Like I never needed anything else. I was just like, this is my deal. Like it to me, alcohol was so versatile. It was an upper. It was a downer. It was a flatliner. Like it was good when I was bored. It was good when I was ramped up. It was good when I needed to be ramped up. I mean, how one drug does all those things. Mm-hmm. It was an incredibly masterful, versatile drug.
What about depression?
Yeah, I know. Thank you for asking me about that.
But I mean, so how tied together were those for you?
Yeah, and it's interesting because there was a section in my book that addressed that a little bit more carefully, and I ended up taking it out because there were just only so many things I could explore. But, you know, I think here's the deal. I'm like a lot of writers and like a lot of drinkers. I'm kind of predisposed to the melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was about 13, my mom can tell you that like they thought really hard about, well, she needs maybe therapy. She needs it was a little early for antidepressants, but if I'd grown up in another generation,
yeah, I
definitely think they would have put me on them.
Yeah.
And so alcohol really appeals to that personality type, mm-hmm, because it lifts the blue,
mm-hmm,
but it also exacerbates the depression of that personality type, mm-hmm, because it amplifies the blue on, you know, Saturdays and Sundays and whenever, you know. And so what was happening to me was that in my 20s, when I really was abusing alcohol, but I was maintaining, I was always manifesting as being depressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd go into the therapist and they'd be like, well, maybe you should quit drinking. And I'd be like, no, I'm not going to do that.
So you were honest with them about how much you drank?
Yeah, I was always honest. You know, my mom's a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been like, if I'm going to spend money on this, I'm going to cough it up and mm-hmm tell them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I would tell them, you know, and then they'd be like, well, maybe you should quit drinking. And I'd be like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, okay, well, so we'll put you on antidepressants and see how it does, but you need to cut the drinking down.
Right, because they don't work.
And I'd be like, okay, that's fine. And then I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So I would start lying to them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so, and I remember one of them telling me, if you take antidepressants and you drink, it's like taking your antidepressants and flushing them down a toilet.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's interesting. That's an interesting theory. I'm going to try my theory,
right,
which is I'm going to do them anyway.
Yeah. That's so, I so get that. I remember realizing, you know, when I got put on antidepressants and they said, don't drink, realizing that there would be no bad interaction. So I was like, well, why wouldn't I?
Well, why not try it, right?
Right.
Like, let me try my way, which is I get to drink all I want and take this pill. And then I think there's always the genuine hope that as you take the pill and the pill helps you, you will not be drinking as much.
Did you have that hope? I mean, I never thought about it like that.
I did. I was, and I don't know, maybe that's a defense mechanism that's like me feeling again like the good girl, like I'm following directions.
Right.
It's just that I would try it for a week. Okay, now that I'm on this pill, I'm not going to drink so much. I'm going to limit myself to these 7 glass. By the way, they would always tell me 7 drinks a week. And I'd be like, nobody can do that.
Right.
I can't do 7 drinks in a night.
Right.
I couldn't.
Right.
But I would tell them like, oh, that's no problem. That seems really reasonable. And I would do it for a week and then I would blow past it. I couldn't do it. And I'd stop counting my drinks. A lot of my defense was not counting, because
mm-hmm
if I didn't count, then I wasn't accountable. Right.
Right. Right.
But it would just slowly move to the back burner. I was always trying to be well behaved though. I mean, I think this is like, I really was always trying to be telling people the truth. I was always trying to be on top of it, but I had the best of intentions, but they would just sort of fade to the background after a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened to me at one point in my mid 30s, near the end of my drinking career, is that I got on antidepressants and they actually made me hypomanic.
Mm.
Have you ever gone hypomanic or do you know anything about that?
I had one night of mania and I don't think it was mania because I went to sleep, but I felt that feeling that people talked about and it scared me and
it was absolutely insane. I didn't understand why I couldn't sleep anymore.
Right. So it was an extended period of time.
It was an extended period of time.
And can I ask what you were on?
I wish I remembered. Was it
it was an SSRI.
Yeah, it was an SSRI. And it was like probably Lexapro, but
right.
Cuz that's the one that I found had the least, like, it didn't have sexual side effects, I
right.
think.
Right. Oh, it doesn't. Yeah.
And they'd put me on Wellbutrin cuz you're supposed to be able to lose weight, and then I went completely insane cuz it
Wellbutrin did nothing for me. Did it actually do things for
me? Made me insane.
It made me an insane
person. Like, I remember I missed the subway and I was like, fucking subway. Like,
right.
I burst into tears.
Right.
And I was like, something's wrong.
Right.
So I was on this other thing and I'm pretty sure it was Lexapro. And I went hypomanic after a certain amount of time. And I was also, this also coincides with my heaviest drinking period. Mm-hmm. I was drinking a lot, like mm-hmm. all the time. And I was starting to stay up all night. So I was trying to drink to get myself down. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I was spiraling into this craziness. And I remember walking down the street in New York and seeing this truck and being like, I think I could stop that truck with my hands. Like, I actually thought that.
Yeah.
And then I called my therapist and I was like, I think something's wrong with me. And the way that I was talking, she was like, I think that you're hypomanic, you know, because I was talking fast and I didn't even know it.
Right.
And so that's when she was like, I think we need to titrate you down off those meds. You need to call your psychiatrist. But like a good little, like I was such an idiot, like a not good little girl.
You were like, I'll just go off.
Yeah. I just threw them. I just tossed them. Yeah. Cause I was like, fuck this. This is horrible.
Yeah.
And then this horrible spiraling out of control withdrawal happened. And
from Lexapro. Yeah.
From
yeah.
Lexapro. And I was like, I still can't even describe it. It was like this weird fever where the only thing that would relieve it was alcohol.
Uh-huh. And was it like that brain? I was on Effexor and the withdrawal, if I forgot a day, I was like dope sick basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what it's, I remember talking to a guy who'd been on heroin and I saw him that night and I was like, I don't know what's going on with me, but if I don't have alcohol every 3 hours, I get really cold and I start to shake and I get nauseated. And he was like, yeah, that happened to me with heroin.
Yeah.
He's like, it's going to last for about 2 days. And he was exactly right. He talked me through it, but he was basically talking me through my. And now that you say, maybe I was on Effexor. I was on both Effexor and Lexapro.
That one, I was on it for years and years. And I like the last year I was taking it, I kept forgetting. And I would feel like the Trainspotting scene with the baby on the ceiling. Like I would just lie there and be like, oh my God, detox is just the worst.
And you got the brain twitches, right?
Brain twitches, nausea, unable to do anything but be in bed and moan.
So I was I had to work from home for 2 weeks after this. Like it was a total freaking meltdown.
Yeah.
And after that, I was like, oh my God, I don't know what's happened, but I just had some kind of crazy chemical meltdown and I need to quit drinking and I need to quit antidepressants.
Right.
And so this is when I tried to stop drinking more in earnest. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work. I was in relapse land for about 2 years.
How long would you stop for?
Like a week and 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then what was going on was I would start again. I remember I went on a date. Never go on a date when you're trying to quit drinking.
Yeah, no.
Never.
Yeah.
And I showed up.
But it's the time you most want to.
And I was like, yeah, because you want to do something.
Yeah, any distraction.
Any distraction. And I showed up and he had a beer in front of him. And I had given myself a talk the whole way there, being like, you can do this, you can do this. And the second I sat down, I was like, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to drink. And I drank and I got wasted and I slept with him that night. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just everything that I had told myself I wasn't going to do.
Right.
And then I was in this strange place of like, I don't really know if I like him, but I slept with him. And
yeah.
And now I mean, I guess I'll see him again.
And then, I should like him because I slept with him.
And I should like him because he's also a nice guy.
Right.
But I don't, your like body has leaped ahead.
Yeah.
And your mind is still kind of like, who's that guy again?
Right, right.
And so we went on a second date and then I drank and slept with him the last time. So I felt like I had to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't walk it back.
No.
You know, so it's... And then I found, and I kept doing things like that where every 2 weeks there would be some excuse of like, well, I need to drink for this reason. So I'm just going to drink tonight. And what started happening was I was drinking every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. which was kind of like not a bad moderation management plan.
Right, right.
And I was like, this isn't bad. Maybe I'll just drink every 2 weeks. But the shame and the self-hatred and all this stuff were a nightmare. Finally, I stopped trying to do that and I just started drinking again.
Yeah.
And then that's when I, like in the book, I tell the story of like moving into this place in Manhattan and getting this apartment by myself. And, you know, I decided I was just going to be a drinker and I was just, you know, and then finally, I quit when I was 35. But the part that I want to point out here is that once I finally quit and I was about a year sober, I think that's when I realized that I was not a depressed person.
Really?
that I was an anxious person.
Right.
I was a highly, highly anxious person. But without the alcohol in my system, I did not struggle nearly so much with a daily or weekly depression.
Mm-hmm.
However, that said, 5 years into my sobriety, I still see that specter of depression sometimes when I'm struggling. And I cry a lot.
You
I
do.
Cry much more than most people.
How often?
I mean, I would say at least daily, if not, oh yeah.
I mean, what kind of crying? So like you're moved by a sad story crying? Or
no, it's always about my life.
It's always, yeah. I don't yeah, really I am cry not, for anyone
You know
else.
What? It's so funny. You know how people always talk about they cry at commercials?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never cried at a commercial.
Okay, I only have when it's something that relates to my life and I'm imagining my life. Like, okay, like the most painful part of your book to me was the cat stuff because of my obsession with my cat and because yeah. every time I pet her, I'm like, she's going to be gone one day.
It's
like,
so
talk
hard.
About when you were talking about like fear, like thinking about death, like that's, I have such an immediate association. And so like I cried at that part of your book.
Because it's about you and your cat.
Yes.
But I think
nothing
that's
to do with you and your
but
cat.
But I think that's why everybody cries.
Yes.
I think when people cry at commercials, they cry because it's some kind of sideways grief that they
yes.
haven't acknowledged.
Yes.
And that moment has hit a kind of hot spot in them.
Yes.
And a lot of times they don't know it. They don't really know the mechanism, the Rube Goldberg machine inside them.
Right.
That's made this, like this little, you know,
yeah.
finger flicked turn into this, you know, this on the other side.
But okay, I was
but
sorry.
To me, it's a much more direct hit.
It's just about things that are happening
I literally
to you.
Only cry about myself.
But like, okay.
And by the way, I still cry about my cat. Sometimes he's been gone for over a year and I miss him so much
yeah.
and it's so intense.
Yeah.
And I've never let, I'm going to cry right now talking
yeah,
about
I
it.
Can't,
and you
can't.
Can cry about your cat because your cat's going to cry
this.
One. I mean, your
okay,
cat,
don't.
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to go there.
No, you can if you need to.
But no. I will see people celebrating their cats on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I will start to cry because my cat's gone.
Yeah.
And, or I'll be crying because something in my life didn't work out the way that I wanted it to, or because somebody didn't love me the way that I wanted them to.
Right.
That is almost exclusively the reasons that I cry.
Right.
And I would say it happens daily. Now there will be valleys of no tears.
Right, right, right. What'd you cry about yesterday? Did you cry? I mean, you're here in like on vacation in LA. Is there less reason to cry?
What did I cry about yesterday?
You did. You're pretty sure you did.
Well, I'm sure I did. No, I know I did. You know, I cried yesterday. Well, I cried in part because, well, and this is something, you know, and a lot of this stuff, this is really personal stuff, you know?
Okay, are you okay with...
Well, I'll just tell you this. I cried yesterday because I've been working on a story, which is for Texas Monthly, which is about alcohol and consent. And I feel really, really like I can't do it and really scared. And I just got really frustrated with myself and I had sort of tears of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
But that tears of frustration are kind of on the very low end of crying. It's very much like, I think I'm just sort of bored or exhausted or something.
You're just getting it out.
You're just getting it out.
Like,
yeah.
You know, there's less of an emotional, you know, connection. When
yeah.
you say you're just like, there's going to be no hangover.
There's not. No. And I think that the deeper tears, they're more about. Yeah, they're more about like I didn't get what I wanted in my life,
mm-hmm.
Or somebody didn't love me the way that I want them to,
mm-hmm.
or I think those might be the two main ones.
Right. Now, how connected do you think fear and depression are? Like how much is depression some, you know, scenario in your brain you do not realize is a scenario you're projecting into the future
yeah.
and you're having a reaction like it's happening at that moment?
You know, I think that, well, are you talking about like the tendency for us to be catastrophizing our lives?
Well, that, and I think that on alcoholism, people, humanism, whatever, but that like, I don't have this thing. And so that means I will never have this thing. And it's as if you've gotten to the end of your life and you have confirmation you'll never have this thing. You know, isn't that what fear is?
Yeah. And I do that. Well, see, a lot of my stuff, I don't know. You know, when I'm crying about what I didn't get, I don't know what part of that is entitlement, is like my ego and entitlement. And I have like really wild swings of ego where I think I deserve things that I don't really deserve.
Right.
And I don't think that should be classified as depression. I think that should be classified as my, you know, getting more real about life, my immaturity and my entitlement.
Yeah.
Which I think are real character defects, to use the terms of the program, that I have and that I struggle with.
Yeah, I had this, you know, and I like about books, like I was just like, my book should have done better, which I really want to ask you about how that connects to happiness. But and then I was like, and I'm like, you know, maybe, and, you know, and I felt entitled, and I'm like, maybe I've gotten way more than I'm entitled to.
Yeah.
Like, what if I never deserved to even get the deals? And I'm sitting here weeping over the fact that they didn't do better. Like, what if I've gotten more than I tell myself that's I'm entitled to, you know? But so now, and I remember when I was trying to sell my first book, I was like, if I sell this book, I will be happy for the rest of my life.
Oh my gosh. I remember thinking that too.
Yeah. And I was just like, and then it happened and I was so happy and I was like, this will last the rest of my life. And maybe a week passed and
it was gone.
But then what about the, if this book does well, I'll be happy for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, anyone listening surely knows that like this, your book has done phenomenally well. You know, New York Times bestseller. I just saw on Amazon today, number one for addiction and recovery.
That's great.
You know this?
No, I don't. I've banned myself from my Amazon page.
Oh, you have.
Because I will get my feelings hurt.
Yeah, there's like 290 reviews.
I know.
Something.
And I've banned myself ever since I went on there one day and I saw someone say, don't bother, was that the headline of it. And it completely cratered my day. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to ever go to the Amazon page again. And I actually have held myself to
it. Yeah, that's really smart.
I don't do it. And I have a very sweet, dear friend who has a touch of the OCD. Mm. And he is always giving me updates on my Amazon page. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, you're number X and Y, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I do hear things about my Amazon page. Like I know the number of reviews and stuff. But I don't actually go to the site myself.
Such self-restraint.
I know. It's self-restraint and self-protection.
Yeah.
Because this is so interesting that you're talking about what will happen if you get success. Because you talked about, you thought, I really thought that if I sold the book, I would just be, that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
And then I realized that's not all I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted the book to do well.
Yeah.
And then I thought if the book just does well, I'll be happy.
Yeah.
And then the book did well.
Yeah. Now what?
And then I realized that didn't make me happy either.
Right.
Which was really hard.
I believe that.
And it's actually something I never talk about.
Well, because it sounds quite obnoxious, but it's not.
I think I'm not allowed to talk about it.
And you, and that I so get, well, my brother just sold a company. He was part of a company that sold for $2.2 billion. And it's like, I've watched it not make him happy.
Yeah.
Like there's just nothing.
And actually when you were talking earlier about things that I cry about, and one of the things that I've cried a lot about is how lonely I feel.
Yeah.
And I think that part of that is because I don't talk about any of this stuff.
Right.
And I don't really, I've felt very estranged from my friends, and I spent a lot of the summer in an anxious posture, very afraid that I was going to screw this up.
How?
I was going to say the wrong thing.
Right.
Like just in this Texas Monthly piece I'm doing about alcohol and consent, which is a really taboo issue. And I want to talk about it. I think it's really interesting. I think I have important things to say. And I'm terrified that I'm going to say it the wrong way. And then it's going to explode. And the thing that I worked for so hard is going to explode in my face. You know, when I was talking earlier about how I'm really entitled and, you know, I think I deserve all these things. Well, that's one part of me. And then the other part of me is cripplingly insecure.
Right.
And scared all the time.
Right.
And I don't have proper confidence in myself. And I don't have the sense of like, you know what? If people are talking about this Texas Monthly story that I write, it's probably because it's an interesting topic and it's not about me. And it's not because I've screwed up, quote unquote.
Right.
It's because I've touched on a subject that matters to people. Like that's like the more mature part of my brain.
Yeah.
And then the kind of crouched in fear, childlike part of my brain is like, I'm going to fuck it up. I'm going to fuck it up. I'm going to fuck this up.
Right. Right. Which is, by the way, the crazy world we live in right now where you can get crucified.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter scares the hell out of me.
I mean, it should scare all of us. I just read this amazing book, John Ronson, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
I loved that book.
Yeah.
And I read it in the months before my book came out, right. Which I think is like reading Carrie before you go to prom. Like, it's so freaking scary. It's just like, this is the worst thing that could happen to you when your book comes out.
Yeah.
Like, it hurt. Like, reading those sections.
The Justine Sacco one.
Oh, my God.
Well, and the Jonah Lehrer in a different
way. I have to
way.
Say the Jonah Lehrer thing, because I am a memoirist who lives in fear of what I've gotten wrong. Do you worry about this?
Yes and no. I have other issues. I mean, no.
You don't. Okay, good. I mean, I shouldn't even say that out loud, no. but it's like, I feel like I wouldn't be honest if I didn't, like, I do things like I show people pages. Is this what it looked like to you? Mm. Like, I go back into my notes. Like, is that what happened? You know, but like I'm waiting to be shown that I got it wrong. Right. You know, I'm waiting for someone to call me up and tell me that I made up the Bob Dylan quotes, you know, like, I'll, by the way, I'm like a paranoid person,
right?
You know? And like, I always thought I was going to be fired at my job, and I always got promoted.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, so this is partly my like mental makeup, is that I am looking for the guy that's going to lunge out of the bushes, you know, like all the time.
Does that get better as the longer you're sober?
Because I feel like less like a fraud. I think, you know, Jonah Lehrer, you know, in a way that story is about somebody who was a fraud.
By the way, I don't think he did much wrong. That's just a side note. Like, I mean, quotes change, plagiarize yourself, everybody's
doing. Oh, well, the plagiarizing yourself thing is not a big deal at all.
But
the making up the Bob Dylan quotes is sloppy, and he should have fact checked. Like, somebody he was in a, like, I think it's sloppy journalism, and I don't think he should have lost his career.
A life destroying mistake? Yeah, I mean, that's madness. But so yeah, I bet it's hard for you to say if this has gotten better, given that this is, you're in the midst of the thing that if you had this fear, it would just be multiplied times a million. Because, but like, now that it hasn't happened, that no one's come out and said, in terms of your book, has that diminished?
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that so many people have read it, you know, it's so funny. I'm so paranoid that some part of me was like, my friends are going to be like, Sarah, you weren't that bad of a drinker. Mm. And my friends were all like, oh, yeah, you were really bad.
Right.
And in fact, like, here's five worse stories we didn't tell you about.
Such a relief.
Yeah, yeah, such a mixed relief, right?
Yeah.
But does it get better? Well, no. In fact, now, you know, I'm going to drive away from this interview and I'm going to be like, I can't believe I put that into the air because I gave it voice, Anna. Like,
no, but that's
like I
good
said Bloody Mary three times in front of the mirror.
But no, but that isn't that like sharing in a meeting? That's how you release it?
Yeah.
You know? And by the way, there's no one who's ever finished this podcast and hasn't said to me, oh my God, that was terrible. Oh my God, I shouldn't have said that. And there's never been an unsuccessful episode.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, this is interesting. I was actually sharing about this in a meeting this morning. That voice that says that,
mm-hmm.
The major change in long-term sobriety for me is that the voice that comes up and is like, oh, that's a lie, or you needed to do that, is so much faster than it used
mm-hmm.
to be.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you get the voice, and then you get that voice that's like, oh, that's bullshit.
Well, yeah.
Do you have that?
You know, well, what I remember, okay, so I remember when the book was coming out and I was like crying to my therapist because I was like, what if somebody catches me, you know, and I don't know what I'm talking about. And she's like, I have a really good fix for that. Don't talk about things you don't know anything
right.
about. And
right.
when you don't know what they're about, just say, I don't know what the answer
right.
to this.
Right.
And I was like, that was the biggest light bulb for me.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, she's totally right. Like, if you don't want to be revealed as a fraud, just tell the truth.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But because so much of my, especially intellectually, because I was a kid that didn't read books in high school. And I was like, you know, I didn't do the work and I was always faking it. Mm-hmm. And so it was really customary for me to be like, let me pretend to know the artist that you just mentioned that I should know who it is. Right. Oh, no, of course I know who that is, you know, but I didn't really know it. So I've learned in sobriety to say, I don't know that person.
Yeah.
And then you might judge me and be like, how could you not know who that person is? But then I don't have to worry that I'm going to be revealed to be a fraud.
Yeah.
So the more that I just remain myself and I just tell the truth about my life, then it's okay.
Right.
Like there's this part in David Carr's memoir where he's writing a note to himself about how to write a good memoir. And he says something like, tell the truth and no harm can come to you.
Right.
You know, and I remind myself of that. You know, just don't pretend. And then you don't have to worry that people will catch you pretending, which I feel like is what Jonah Lehrer was doing. You know, he was pretending.
Yeah.
And people caught him pretending.
Yeah. But since it's not a conscious thing, it's really, really hard. I mean,
well, also a lot of people are pretending. Yeah. Like it's a common sin.
And it's like a part of our culture is, and this is something that recovery has been so interesting to me because our culture is like, you know, be an expert, will yourself into this and get this by stomping on people and to learn that, oh my God, I had it totally backwards. Like if I want happiness, I got to not think about myself so much. I got to surrender.
That's
to
exactly
what's
right.
You know,
that's exactly right. And I think one of the, to go back to what we were talking about, the success of the book, like I'm so happy for the success of the, no, I'm so like it's incredibly gratifying.
Yeah.
That people want to talk about the book. I enjoy it. I actually really genuinely enjoy engaged conversations about the book's themes and the things that come up. I like going to events. But none of it made me happy in a way of like, I sit back at the beach and I'm like, look at what I did.
Right.
This feels good. I'm still me. And I'm still carrying around my me problems. You know, that I don't like this part about my body, or I don't like this thing about my behavior, or I don't this or that or the other thing. And I do think that one of the things I'm starting to finally get at the age of 41 is that if I want to be happy, my happiness can't be totally in the bucket of how successful I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because also the success is going to go away.
You said
maybe it won't. Wonder,
like,
look, maybe
like Barry Diller's always been successful. Like I'm like there are yeah. Scott, you know, whatever.
Maybe it won't, but
I'll
tell you the
gonna
attention's
work.
Gonna go away. But the success isn't doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And the times when I feel happy are when I'm talking to somebody else about their life.
Yeah.
When somebody comes up to me and talks to me about their life, and their story. Or when somebody's telling me about how the book brought up something for them, like then I feel useful.
Mm-hmm.
Then I feel like, oh, good. There's some. I did something that had value, like it had meaning to people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the more I stay into where I am on Amazon,
yeah,
that's a fucking losing game.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Did you? But okay. So when did you realize that it was going to be successful? I mean, like, what was the thing, you know, the book, you know, comes out, you spent.
Well, so I think there was a bunch of media attention, but I thought maybe that was just because I knew a bunch of people.
Right.
And so I kind of blew it off. Like I don't want to say blew it off, like I took it for granted, but I didn't think it was a metric of the book doing well.
And it's not always.
Because I had all these friends from working in the media for 15 years and from working with a lot of freelancers, working with, you know, as a personal essays editor, I had relationships with all these different freelancers.
Yeah.
Who wanted to interview me and yeah. Then place the interview in a magazine.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's good for them. It's good for me. That's great. That's mutually beneficial. I understood that there was interest in the topic, but see, I didn't realize it was going to be a success. Now keep in mind that my publisher and my editor, had been telling me it's going to be a success, mm-hmm. but this is my first book.
Yeah.
I thought maybe they told everybody that.
I think they might.
And so I just thought they don't like that to me, it was like your mom telling you that you look pretty. You're
right.
Like, well, you have to say that you're my mom.
Right.
And
right.
So I didn't really, know who to turn to. And then my agent who I think does see a lot of these different things, was kind of always trying to brace me for it being a failure. And yeah. I mean this in a kind way,
yeah.
that I think she was always trying to get me to think about it like, the successes that you wrote it, the successes that were here, like, because she's seen so many writers crushed when it right. didn't achieve X, Y, right. or Z. And so she can't predict the future.
Right.
So I really didn't know until that first week and it landed on the bestseller list.
Oh, it did in the first week?
Yeah. And that was really my first indication. I mean, that it was going to be a success, that it was a success.
Right.
And I think that was... The day before that was the New York Times review from Dwight Garner, which mm-hmm. was really positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was those two things at yeah. once that was very much the moment of, okay, kid, you've made it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it was an incredible feeling. I mean, I've talked about, oh, I'm lonely and I cry yeah. and Anna, be my friend.
Right.
But let me tell you, those were good days.
Yes. Yes.
That was incredible. It was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, and both can be true.
Yeah.
You know, simultaneously. And I think it's, you know, but I feel like that voice then goes, oh my God, I got to do this again. Right? You know, I mean, that's, you know, what now? I got to live up to, or whatever. I mean, I'm putting Ferris M into
Well,
your head.
I think I'm starting to feel that now because I'm starting to
They're
think
going, what's
about,
your next book?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm starting to think about the next book and I'm starting to think about the next thing. And it's like, you know, I really went through this thing right around that time where I had been in so much anxiety and so much turmoil leading up to that moment that I really started to think I didn't want to write another book
mm-hmm.
and that I would be better served, doing a different kind of writing, whether mm-hmm. it was essay writing, whether it was magazine writing, something that was a little bit lower stakes, because I think it's a little bit like somebody that has a kid and is just like, love the kid, never going to go through that again.
Yeah, yeah.
But then what happens is the memory fades yeah. and you get a little bit further away from it and you start to think like, I could do that again.
And I survived it.
I survived it. I wasn't so bad. So, you know, but I did have this thought the other day of like, oh my God, I got to do this whole thing over again. Oh, I don't know if I have it in me. You know, I think also because the drinking story was so obviously the book for me,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, we talked before, I think before you turned this on, we talked a little bit about, you know, I don't have the most dramatic addiction right. and recovery story. There's no question. I have very much a garden variety drinker story. Some bad things happen to me. They are very much in the middle of the spectrum of what happens to somebody in a drinking life.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly many, many worse things happen to many people in the course of a drinking or any kind of, you know, addiction, drug using life.
Mm-hmm.
However, I knew and loved alcohol unlike anything else in my life. And it was so abundantly clear to me that that was the subject of my first book.
Right. Right.
It didn't matter that I didn't have the scariest story.
Yeah.
I will put my mental obsession up against anyone's.
Right. Right.
Like,
right.
I had a love and a mental obsession for that liquid that I will, you know, I will fight you to the death.
Right.
About it.
Right.
And so I knew that I could write about it.
Yeah.
And that it would sustain years of interest, investigation, toil. You know, both examining why I liked it, how I could manage to continue to let go of it and build a life without it.
Yeah.
So, they talk about write what you know, and there was just no question. Like, right. I knew booze.
Yeah.
I knew booze more than anything else.
Do you, was it shocking to you that you were able to let it go?
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. Because my identity was so wrapped up in it. And so I just didn't think that I thought, well, I could quit drinking, but it's just going to be this incredibly boring,
oh yeah,
colorless life.
Oh yeah.
And so I didn't, it's not that I thought quitting drinking was impossible so much as I thought life without alcohol being any fun whatsoever was impossible.
Yes.
And the fact that I can sit in a bar, and like the other night, people were, I was at a Labor Day party, and that was last night, and somebody next to me was drinking a Negra Modelo, which I used to love that drink, and I could smell it, you know. And I was drinking my, I was on my seventh glass of San Pellegrino.
Oh, you know? So you don't screw around. You still drink as much. It's just different things.
I fucking still drink as much, man. I
nurse one cranberry soda every night.
Do you?
That's all.
Yeah, so
it turns out I wasn't that thirsty. You know, it's a good drink with a dash of cranberry with lime. I'm just going to say.
It's a great drink.
It's a signature drink.
Yeah. That's classy. I like it too. And especially when you want to be somewhere where it looks like you're having a cocktail.
Do you care about that?
Do I care about that? Every once in a while.
Really?
Normally, no. But well, every once in a while, I don't want attention.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want attention.
And do you
for not
think
drinking.
Does that call attention to you when people? Well, I guess people really go, "What? You're not having a drink?"
Nobody says that to me anymore.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, now,
but,
never again.
But both of us are publicly sober. Yeah. Everyone knows that we're sober.
But do you meet people who have no idea?
Yeah.
You know, I just met somebody last week who was just like so confused by, you know, that whole like, what do you mean? And you can't smoke weed? You know, that conversation.
You're well, like, I think it comes up around dating. And I'm curious how you deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I have such a strange relationship with it. I, you know, the first week I was sober, and I've totally written about this, I went to a bar to meet somebody and I was like, can I have a Diet Coke? Because, you know, I was this terrible cocaine addict and I can't drink. I just told everybody.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me not to. And I don't know why. And
maybe
so,
I felt safer. Did I feel safer doing that?
I'm still not conscious of why I did it.
Yeah.
And I don't
You're
know.
You're the non-noticer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if I thought it was insurance against not doing it. I think I'm like a chronic oversharer.
It sounds like to me.
Like that's my motivation for most things.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll get attention.
Yeah. And you didn't think it was bad attention?
For me, I'm like an equal opportunity attention getter. Like if it's bad attention, doesn't matter.
That's
it's attention.
Great.
It's crazy.
That's
I'm
great.
Still like that. But whatever. Good attention, better
I mean,
than
it's,
bad.
It's great in the sense of it's funny. I love human behaviors that that makes sense. You know, I'm not like that. I had so much invested in being a drinker that being a non-drinker felt very shameful to me.
Interesting.
So when I showed up at a bar and I wasn't drinking, I did not want to call attention to it. And I did not want to let people know because I thought it meant I wasn't cool. And I was very afraid they were going to come to the conclusion that I wasn't cool.
Yeah. See, I've been under this perception my entire sobriety that it's cooler than drinking.
You're right.
I mean, I was so desperately uncool when I was a drunk and a coke addict that like immediately I was cooler by not doing it.
You're absolutely right. But I wonder, did you get sober in LA?
Yes. Well, there's that
and
too.
And I think LA is such a cool sober community.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. It's really the norm to just have been a decadent drunk or drug addict and now not be.
Yeah.
But so, okay. So when you go on a date, well, now it's all blown to hell because everybody knows you're sober. But like before the
book. They don't on Tinder. I mean, people are still just like, who are you? What do you write?
But so then
like,
they go, what do you write?
So what do you write? And I'm like, okay, I write some first person stories. Well, can I see one?
Yeah.
And as soon as I give them my first and last name, they know everything about me. And I don't want that before I meet them.
Yeah.
But so it's been very awkward. I've had a very fitful re-entry onto the dating sites, which I only recently did like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so because fresh. I took myself off for a while to focus on the book and I didn't want the distraction of it. And then I was like, you know what? It's time.
Yeah.
And so I haven't been able to explain like, I mean, I feel like I have to do the download that you used to do in week one of your sobriety, which is like, hey, I'm Sarah. I used to be a crazy drinker. I wrote this book about it. Kind of talks about sex stuff. You can look it up online. You know, like, hey, meet me for coffee. You know, like, I don't want to do all that. And so what I end up doing is saying weird things like, I just prefer not to tell you what I write until we meet. And then it sounds like...
That sounds crazy.
It sounds like a crazy person.
Yeah.
I know.
There's... You know, there is no way around. I used to do a thing with online dating where I had another email address where it wouldn't say my name, you know, because I just don't Google before, you know.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of, and like, you know, I don't know, once your age is on Wikipedia, you just sort of give up on it all. And I'm just like, fine, this is it, you know.
So you just let it hang out. You say, I'm Anna David, I'm, you know, I'm
I mean, you know, as soon as they go, well, especially with this like after party thing, it's like, oh, well, what's that? You know, there's no,
because it's in your email address.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's just something that I think there's no use fighting.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and if somebody's got a problem with it, good to know up front.
It's always good to know up front. I always put sober in my profile because...
Like on Tinder?
I do. Is that okay. A bad move?
No, I don't think so. But that's so interesting that then you would want them to not know that you wrote this like amazing best-selling book. I mean, I get it, sort of.
Maybe what you're saying is that I'm front-loading the less interesting parts of myself and I'm burying the lead.
But maybe that's like not wanting attention, you know.
I think I have mixed up. Well, I talk about this in my book. I'm very mixed up on attention, you know, where I just have this feeling of like, nobody look at me. Why isn't anyone looking at me? Well,
I hear people, sober people say that all the time. And I don't relate. I always want
because
them looking.
It's
weird. I wonder because everybody talks about that. Like, you know, that I'm the speaker in the meeting and like, you know, it just feels so weird because I don't want people to, like, really? Look. Listen.
Do we have time to talk about attention? Can we talk about that?
Oh, wait. Let's talk about attention. Yeah.
So I'm curious then because you talk, you know, I mean, you're a very pretty woman. And
as
so, thanks. But I've gone up and down on the scale like 50 pounds. You know?
As have I. By
You've
the way.
Been a heavier woman.
Yeah, I was 146 at one point.
Mm-hmm.
My parents sent me to a nutritionist.
How old were you?
I was going to say this about paranoia, by the way. When I was, I think I was 28. And I remember going to therapy and going, I fear I've gotten fat and I fear I'm going to get fired. And she was like, well, that's paranoia. And I got fat and I was fired.
So
what about when, you know, as they say, it's like, it's not paranoia if you're right.
If you're right, I know.
But okay, so yeah, go on.
Well, I'm just wondering why it is that you experience all attention as good and I experience it as such a crazy mixed bag of like, come here, go away, go, no, I want you, don't, I don't. And I wonder, maybe it comes down to essential. Are you a natural extrovert?
I wonder about that. I do think the answer is formative years more than anything.
It's got to be.
You know, I will say I have a weird, I love how we've made it about me and it is a perfect meta experience because we're talking about attention. But I remember being a kid and people saying like, oh, you're so shy like your dad. And I didn't want to be like my dad and I didn't want to be shy. And then I met a girl when I was 10, Janae Schumacher, Facebook friends. And she was, I remember my mom being like, she's so gregarious. And I thought, I want to be described that way. And it's like I changed overnight.
Wow.
So I don't know. But I don't know what that has to do with like the... I don't know. So what do you think that I want attention, I don't want attention is sort of that same thing of, you know, I'm entitled. Oh, I don't deserve anything.
I think they're all tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's some funny pendulum swing that's always going on in my brain. That's like... because I think it's... I think it starts with... I deserve all the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's immediate switchback to, oh my God, no, I'm a fool. Everybody else is more interesting than me. I don't deserve attention at all. Why did I ever think I deserved attention? Nobody should look at me. I want to die and disappear. So it's a
so interesting.
It's a reaction to the roar of entitlement that begins.
Right.
You know, like I was at a writer's event recently and I was like, I walked in with this real entitlement of like, I'm better than all these people. Mm-hmm. And then I started realizing they were really cool and really great.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh my God, I'm worse than all these people. I can't believe I came in here thinking I was better than these people. Now I feel ashamed at how much better I felt. So there's a corrective quality to it. And it's a backlash.
Well, and it's extremism. Like
it's extreme.
Alcoholism. I mean, I think I more have, you know, I had a therapist who'd say, you know, you're either the shit or the piece of shit. Like I will have that. It doesn't have to do with attention for me, but I will have that about thing, you know, like self-perception.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I also think that I am, I really am torn between my introvert and extrovert selves. My father was extremely shy
mm-hmm.
and I did not want to be him either.
Mm-hmm.
However, I didn't fight it hard mm-hmm. enough. You know, like alcohol really overrode that part of me mm-hmm. and I was a complete and total extrovert. Mm-hmm. I mean, an exhibitionist, very aggressive, I was all of those things. And then when I was sober, I was always the opposite of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does feel, I always feel a little bit like my mom and dad are always fighting inside of me the same way they did in my childhood. Like when they were always fighting in the next room. And I feel like it's my genetics and they're just like fighting behind locked doors. And I do think I'm like 50% my mom, who's an extrovert and very, very natural around people.
Yeah.
And my father, who is congenitally shy and very skeptical of strangers.
Yeah.
And so that's always fighting in me.
But what about the idea that, you know, I mean, easy for me to be like, I'm almost 15 years sober, blah, blah, blah. But like that you don't really know who you are. And like as sobriety unfolds, you start to realize more and more who you are.
I think that's hard for people to believe because they would think 5 years sober, shouldn't you figure out who the hell you are yet?
Yeah.
But I mean, every time I talk to sober people that have many years like you do, they're like, oh my gosh, you're a baby.
Well,
you know,
like, and I have no idea. I mean, I remember my sponsor in New York turning 20 years sober, and she's like, oh my God, I finally get what they say when they say you didn't know anything till you were 20 years sober.
That's crazy.
I know.
But I think that you do start to, you know, the self-awareness that you gain through that is immense. And 5 years really isn't a long time.
Yeah, it is and it isn't.
I mean, it is a long time and I'm proud of it. And I don't mean to be diminishing of that time but at all because it's, because by the way, the person that quit drinking at 35 was like, no way could I go 5 years.
Of course. I mean,
five days is insane
back then.
So 5 years is crazy, but I do have this awareness that I'm still getting to know myself.
Yeah.
Like when you asked me that question about depression, for a long time, I've been saying I'm not a depressed person because once I quit drinking, I really didn't struggle with it. But lately I have been struggling with it. And so I'm starting to think that was maybe a too easy of an answer to say, oh, I'm not depressed. The alcohol made me depressed.
Right.
I'm starting to think maybe I am. And I just have certain, you know, triggers that I'm dealing with right now. And, you know, and so, yeah, I'm just getting to know myself.
Yeah. I mean, I know when I first got sober, my first year was so magical and wonderful. I was like, no more therapy, no more medication. Who needs it? My problem was I was an alcoholic and now it's solved.
You were one of those pink cloud people.
Pink cloud for a year. Imagine having a pink cloud every day for a year.
Oh man. I wanted it so bad. I was so miserable, but yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know how people stay sober without that.
I don't know how I did. I really don't. It sucked so bad. And people have asked me a lot. I think that's really the magic question because it's not why did you quit, because I'd quit 100 times. There's so many reasons to quit.
Yeah.
It's how do you stay quit?
Yeah.
How do you stay when it's not, when you're unhappy?
Yeah.
When you're not getting your rewards?
Yeah. I mean, and for me, I've had many unhappy, not many, I've had certainly unhappy periods of my sobriety, but I have all that, this too shall pass. I get it because I had that initial, it was so joyful, you know? So how did you? I mean, this is a good note to end on.
Yeah. I mean, I that's also still a mystery to me, but I know that at about the 3 month mark, you know, in my sobriety, it started to become clear to me how much I had worried people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had really, a lot of my drinking was enabled by this idea that I wasn't hurting other people. You know, I would hear people say, oh, well, I'm hurting my husband or my kids. And I was like, not me. I don't have those things. No problem over here. And I kept my job, right? But as I was getting more sober, it was becoming clear to me that my friends had really worried and that my mother and my father had really worried and they had swallowed a lot of fear and they were in pain. They didn't know how to do, they didn't know what to do or what to say. And about 3 months in, my brother got called up to Iraq. He was in the reserves. And so I saw my mother go through more fear than I ever had. Mm. Like she was really, really worried about him, even though he was going to a very safe and remote part of Iraq, or as safe as those parts could be. But she was so worried. And I remember thinking, I couldn't put both her kids in danger.
Mm.
And I remember being really angry that I couldn't relapse. I was like,
interesting.
God, she took away my relapse.
Right.
And I was so mad because I had about 3 months, which is right around the time that I normally relapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, all right, fine. Shit. I'm just going to keep going.
Mm.
And so then at about 6 months was when I got the idea of writing the book. And then I think probably the book kept me sober. The idea of the book.
She spent 3.5 years writing it, 4.
Yeah, I spent 3 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, honestly,
just trying to figure out what to say. I wrote different versions of the book that never happened. Like, I didn't know if I was going to write a memoir or a nonfiction book or a reported book, or there were all sorts of things that went into it. I mean, the actual writing of it probably took a year and then a lot of time editing. I mean, you know, but it was a very slow going process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It always is, I think.
Well, I wanted it to be instant because I like everything instant. I wanted to write it in three or four months and then and then sell it for a bunch of money and be done. Yay!
Yeah, and then have it come out like immediately.
Immediately.
What takes so long?
Yeah.
You know?
But I do know that having this promise that I could do something in my sober life that I hadn't done in my drinking life, which is what I wanted to do more than anything else on the earth, mm-hmm. really. More than have kids, more than get married, more. I wanted to write a book. That was my brass ring. And if I could do that in my sober life, then that would mean I had accomplished something that I had proven to myself that I was better sober.
So interesting. And then things got better. You got out of the
difficult part. And then what happened is that things got better.
Yeah.
I moved out of New York, which I really needed to do.
Are you going to stay in Texas?
I don't know.
Could LA woo you?
It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that Texas was exactly where I needed mm-hmm. to be for that 4 years. And to go back to Dallas, which is the place that I had grown up hating so much, mm-hmm. and to return home and to feel like it was totally right for me, mm-hmm. and to love it and to feel like, oh, thank God I'm back, like to be in the soil where I was planted. It was a very profound feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And to be close to my family and to just have everything, like I had spent so much of my life trying to be an impressive person and trying to impress everyone around me with, like, I live in New York. Mm-hmm. I live in a cool neighborhood mm-hmm. in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I live on this street, you know, and just like getting all those little coins from the universe for being like an impressive person.
Mm-hmm.
To let go of that and to be like, I live in Dallas, Texas, and I live really close to my parents. And I'm close to my parents and I like them very much. Mm-hmm. And like it was all
nothing
the things.
Cool about that.
There was nothing cool about it. And it was exactly what I needed to be doing. And I knew it. And so that was so good for me.
Yeah.
And like you say, it started to get better. I started to get better. I started to get happier. And I became more of the person I wanted to be. And so that was the crazy thing. When I actually became the person that I was drinking to be, that's when I realized, oh, I don't need alcohol for this.
So well said. That's so, so, so true. I love it to the point that I'm going to have to stop it right now so we don't eat.
Okay, so I won't screw it up.
Yeah. All right. Have you already ordered Blackout? Your second copy, your third copy? Go get it. Go read up on her and go keep listening to this podcast. This was After Party Pod. With Sarah Heppala as the guest.